I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
Happy New Year! We're back and ready to jump back into impolite conversations. This week, we're talking about why smaller churches are the ones at the forefront of being LGBT affirming.
We'll also discuss the passing of Thomas S. Monson, the late president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and what the process of choosing a new leader for the Mormon Church looks like.
And for our deep dive, we'll take a look at news that broke late last week, a hashtag Church2 story about a popular Memphis area pastor who is accused of sexually assaulting a teenager when he was her youth pastor, and about the damage that purity culture has caused to so many in the evangelical world.
We're going to start with an update on something we've been following since our very first episode. It's the project called Church Clarity that is assembling a database of U.S. churches and noting whether or not they've clarified their church stand on being LGBT affirming.
In the past 2 months, Church Clarity has published information of about 500 congregations, including the 100 largest churches in the country, as listed in Outreach Magazine. What they found probably won't shock most of you. It didn't shock me at all. But seeing the findings laid out in very stark terms like this is pretty damning.
Among the things they found is that 93% of America's largest churches are led by a white pastor. Shocker. Only one church, that's Faith Church in West Palm Beach, has a female lead pastor. And even she is co-pastor with her husband. But what we want to talk about today is the fact that not a single one of the 100 largest churches in the country is LGBT affirming.
Not one. It's...
Nish.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, that's the truth. Like, I see this happening, LGBT affirmation happening on a much smaller scale, preferably in more progressive denominations, smaller congregations. It's just not moving. Like, the needle is not moving in some of these big, massive evangelical churches. And I have a couple theories as to why, but I would love to hear your thoughts as well. It's frustrating to me. And yet at the same time, I'm also pretty hopeful because I see movement happening kind of like in a groundswell. It's more kind of grassroots feel to it. I don't know if that makes sense, but...
It does, but I want to hear some of your theories, because the groundswell will make a difference. If these 100 largest churches don't change at all, though, that's a pretty big example and a pretty visible example. I guess one of the things that maybe doesn't surprise me about this, but that kind of challenges my assumptions, is I have been talking about Church Clarity with a good friend when I was back in Michigan for Christmas, who's a loyal listener. Hello. And she was saying that she had mixed feelings about the Church Clarity project because she belongs to kind of a small church plant that is out ahead of where its denomination is on LGBT issues. And so while for all intents and purposes, her pastor is affirming and most folks at the congregation are affirming, they know that they can't necessarily do something official and permanent because that would risk losing affiliation status and some resources there. And, you know, it's a question that a lot of churches are confronting right now. It's similar to kind of what went on decades ago with race and a lot of denominations. And there will be those who say, you know, that's a risk that you got to take as the leader of a church. But it's a very real one. And it's where, in theory at least, you would think that some of these big mega churches that are often non-denominational, that are so... I don't want to say cult of personality, but, you know, there's one or two people who are really driving them, that they have a little more freedom in terms of not having institutional shackles or institutional teachings that they have to reflect. to kind of go off on their own and to make these kinds of changes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's definitely one of my theories, is the attachment to institutions. So I would actually be curious. I would want to go through the list of 100 largest churches that are listed here and actually figure out which ones maybe are SBC. There are a lot of churches that I've been surprised by that seem totally non-denominational, not attached to any sort of major religious institution or conference, but they are. And so I would be interested to see out of those 100, which ones are still attached to some sort of denominational structure and rely on that denominational structure for things like staff funding and, I mean, a whole bunch of other things, right? So that's definitely one piece. The second piece that I would want to take a look at out of this, you know, 100 largest churches is, and I know this is a cynical take, and so I apologize for that up front. It's just on the forefront of my brain that I genuinely wonder, like, how many of those churches have a lead pastor of some sort who has a book deal, who has some sort of, like, you know, speaking circuit. They have investments in Christian culture at large that helps bolster their image, bolster their income, bolster all those sorts of things, that if they were to step out and take their congregation in a different direction, in towards LGBT affirmation, would they lose their book deal? Would they lose their speaking engagements? Would they lose, you know, all of these other things that are kind of ancillary to their quote unquote platform? Would they be risking all of that? I mean, we know just from, you know, our colleagues and friend circles that there's a cost there. There's a big cost to stepping out, outside of that, and to be LGBT affirming if you do have book deals, if you do have speaking engagements. I mean, I've experienced that myself. And there's a heavy cost. Now, I am of the mind that, like, it's 100% worth it. I would do it all over again and never look back. But there's a cost there. And so I also wonder, does that play a part in some of these decisions of these churches to not start taking steps toward that? Now, again, I said that's cynical. And a lot of it may just be that they don't hold the theological conviction. They don't see it. They can't make it work theologically for them. And with, you know, I have respect for that. We can read scripture differently. And so that's the other option too, is that they just don't see it. And so they can't support it. But I do wonder, out of that list of 100 churches, which ones still are attached to some sort of institutional authority? How many of those pastors have big book deals and all sorts of Christian culture influence, and how that plays a part in some of these things? I don't know. You can't help but ask. You know, you just can't help but ask that question.
Yeah, it's a really good point about the kind of Christian machine, if you will. It's been a revelation to me in the last year as I have kind of waded back into at least learning more about conservative evangelical culture, the extent to which that really exerts a serious pull on a lot of figures, even people who from the outside I had kind of assumed had a little more freedom and leeway because they weren't part of official church structures that could call them to account. And yet the more I look into it, the more I'm realizing that they are just as hampered and sometimes muzzled because it's their livelihood. And, you know, it's in sometimes some ways cynical. You know, I think somebody who's already got a church empire, maybe they could lose that book deal and they'd still be okay. But for many people, it is how they are paying the bills. And I think that's going to be something looking forward that we are certainly going to be exploring here, is the church conference circuit and the publishing circuit and kind of what the requirements are and the punishments that await people who break from the commonly accepted teachings, at least. Just one thing to throw out there with Southern Baptist, maybe to look at in the future. I wonder whether that will start to change if Southern Baptists continue to keep losing members. You know, it's been a drop in the millions in terms of people attending SBC churches. And, you know, I know, for instance, we were kind of shocked at my DC church to discover a few years ago that we were officially still on the rolls as a SBC church. We were as far from fitting in the SBC mold as you could possibly get. Definitely affirming all female pastors. We were the first and perhaps only Baptist church to ordain a trans minister. And yet, until one of our members looked into it and brought it to our attention, we didn't realize we were still officially SBC.
You'd be surprised how many stories I've heard about that. That like churches you would never in a million years think are SBC actually are.
So I'm wondering how much the SBC really doesn't want to kick people off because they can't afford to lose more numbers than they already are. But I'll throw out just kind of one of my theories of why smaller churches have been at the forefront. Just in general, I think they've got less to lose, obviously. You know, when you've already got a small congregation, you're used to losing members and gaining some more over here. But also, just in terms of resources, there are many of them in denominations that are already struggling financially. You know, I don't want to get into church finances here, but just to say that it's not like they're risking the loss of licensing deals or, you know, thousands of members or shutting down one campus in their, you know, five campus ministry. You know, so in a weird way, you've got a little more freedom when you're already a floundering, shrinking church to be able to take more forward-looking stands.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that we're seeing too, and again, this is pretty anecdotal evidence. I don't have any statistics to back this up, so take it with a grain of salt. But in my own circle of relationships and acquaintances, people that I know who have left the kind of big white conservative evangelicalism, these kind of big churches that hold these more traditional views, the people that I know who have left those, there's usually two options. They have left church altogether and would be classified under the like nuns category, or they've moved into small, intentional, sometimes very deeply denominational traditions. Things like the Episcopal Church. They've actually moved more left in their theology when they're looking at church affiliation. And so I think it makes sense that some of these smaller churches, not only are they kind of at their core a little bit more progressive, but we're seeing disaffected white evangelicals over this issue who are leaving these big, you know, white evangelical churches because of the LGBT issue, pouring into some of these smaller communities and bolstering that LGBT affirmation stance. And so it seems like it could also just be, frankly, a numbers game. You just never know. But I know that that's kind of been my experience with all the people that I know who have walked away from kind of that traditional evangelical model. They've also moved into smaller communities who are more LGBT affirming. And those LGBT communities have come out and been even more vocal advocates of that position, or it has enforced that position even more. So it's another thing to consider as well.
Yeah, well, and I'll just say before we move on, I'm excited to see Church Clarity get into looking at the role of women.
Yes.
In American churches, because I think when it comes to the LGBT issues, it's probably a toss-up between, as I said, some more progressive churches that are maybe more out front than their denomination wanting to kind of keep things a little vague purposely, and some larger churches also wanting to be vague, understanding that younger evangelicals are much, much more supportive and affirming.
Yeah.
But I would guess when it comes to not wanting to put down for the record that your church doesn't ordain women and doesn't accept women as leaders, you're going to see most of that on the conservative end of the spectrum, with churches very happily being vague about that and preferring that people just assume, oh, they don't happen to have a female pastor right now. But it's just not an official stand that the church has taken, that they wouldn't hire a female pastor, they wouldn't ordain a woman.
Right. Because, I mean, I know, having looked at a bunch of different church websites that are listed on Church Clarity, it's really interesting. Like, you kind of maybe assume, because you look at their staff list and you're like, oh, she's the, you know, director of children's ministry, or she's the director of this, but it doesn't say pastor next to her name, but yet she oversees an entire ministry. Or there is some, like, a woman who's listed as a pastor, but they only oversee kids ministry. You know what I mean? Like, so you just don't know, like, okay, so can you be a pastor over, like, children, but you can't preach? Can you be an elder? Like, there's all sorts of these weird kind of different approaches that churches can use to kind of make the issue a little convoluted based on titles and exactly what title does what and all of that stuff, that I think if churches were forced to step out and say, like, no, we do affirm women as leaders, or we don't, either as, you know, pastors, preachers, elders, whatever that looks like within that particular church or denomination, I would be really interested to see how that pans out. Because I think there are some people who, like what you were saying, are under the assumption and operate in their churches under the assumption that women are allowed to do whatever. And like, oh, they just don't happen to have a female leader, when actually they're not allowed to. And so I would be really interested to see how that shakes out. But we'll see. We'll see if they decide to go that route. I'm not sure.
But for now, we have a another Utah-based story that you're going to tell us about.
Yeah, Utah, man. We are just in the news.
All over the news.
Oh, and we're going to continue to be in the news. You just wait. You wait. It's coming.
We're going to make Nish wait to talk about Orrin Hatch for a few weeks. But
and Mitt Romney. I'm gonna hold my tongue this week, but it's coming. The rage is coming. On Tuesday night, around 10 p.m. of last week, President Thomas S. Monson, the prophet and leader of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, passed away in his home here in Salt Lake City. He was 90 years old. He served in some leadership capacity in the church since he was 22 when he was first called as a bishop. A bishop is kind of like a lay pastor that oversees a congregation. And he was one of the longest serving leaders in the church's history, having been called as an apostle back in 1963. And he served under three different church presidents before he was called as the president of the church himself. And his funeral will be held this week here in Salt Lake City at the LDS Church Conference Center, with thousands expected to be in attendance, tens of thousands. If you've been on social media this week and you have any Mormon friends or neighbors, you've probably heard of his passing. It's a big deal among the LDS faithful when a prophet of the church dies and a new one is selected. And this brings up the question, how is a new prophet chosen in the Mormon church? To help us answer that question, I thought it would be best to ask an expert, so I interviewed Anthony Sweat. Anthony is a professor of church history at Brigham Young University, and prior to his time at BYU, he worked for 13 years with seminaries and institutes of religion in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as both a teacher and an administrator. Anthony, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you, Nish. So happy to be with you and with your listeners.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. Okay, so from a quick 30,000-foot view, I'd like it if you could walk our listeners through the process of prophetic succession, assuming that we know nothing about the leadership structure of the LDS Church. How does this work?
Okay, well, the LDS Church, basically, its highest governing body is called the First Presidency. And the First Presidency is run by the president, or what we refer to and believe is a prophet for the church. And then he has two counselors. So those three men make up the First Presidency. And then the next highest governing body is called the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. It's made up of 12 men who are have the rank of apostle within the church. And the First Presidency are the ones that oversee and govern the church together with the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. So the way prophetic succession happens is when a current church president dies, his counselors are automatically released. And so there's no more First Presidency. Mm-hmm. Think of it that way, that the First Presidency dissolves. Mm-hmm. So the counselors... Generally, the counselors come from the apostleship. They were apostles themselves when they were made counselors, so they retake their seats back in seniority in the apostleship. And I'll tell you about that. And the way seniority works in the apostleship is it's who has been an apostle the longest.
Not by age.
Not by age.
Okay.
So age is irrelevant. It has to do with when they were called and how many years they've served as an apostle. So the longest serving apostle in terms of tenure, mm-hmm. who's been an apostle the longest, is what's known as the president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles.
Okay.
So when the first presidency dissolves, when the prophet dies, and the first presidency dissolves, and those two members of the first presidency, his counselors, retake their seats in the apostleship, now the highest governing body in the LDS Church is the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and the president of the 12 is now the highest presiding officer within the church. And so they meet as a body, and they basically, the president of the 12 will put forward a motion that just says, is it time to reorganize the first presidency of the church? And they call for a vote, and if it's a unanimous vote, then they typically, historically, have always sustained the senior apostle, the highest ranking apostle, as the new presiding figure for the LDS Church, or what we would call the presiding high priest or president.
Okay.
And is that convoluted enough for everybody?
You explained it very well. And the person who currently holds the position of president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, so the most senior serving member of the Quorum, is Russell M. Nelson. Is that correct?
Russell M. Nelson. Yes, that's his name. Yep.
Okay. And how old is he? Do you know how old he is off the top of your head?
I believe he's 93 off the top of my head.
I was going to say he's in his 90s, I thought.
Yeah, he is.
He's much older.
But his youth and energy, you know, they betray, you wouldn't figure he's 93 by how energetic he is.
That's very true.
Yeah, when I looked it up, it surprised me how he was already 93.
Yeah, I had the great pleasure of hearing him speak down at the Missionary Training Center in Provo, and I was amazed. I was like, I can't believe he's in his 90s. I was like, wow, that's amazing. Pretty awesome. Okay, so my next question is, has there ever been a time in the church's history when the most senior serving member of the Quorum was not selected as the next president?
No, it's always followed that pattern.
Okay.
You know, I've looked at some of the church's literature that they put out when they, like on the LDS Church, they have a newsroom website, and I just glanced at that just recently. And they do leave open the possibility that somebody else could be selected from within the apostleship. But historically, it has always been the presiding senior most apostle.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, we can probably assume that the Quorum will stay on brand, as we said, so to speak, and will select Russell M. Nelson as the next president of the church. And every kind of previous president kind of has their general ethos that they put out into the world. Like when I think of Gordon B. Hinckley, I think of his like media savvy. He was very, you know, one with the media, and one of his big teachings. I'm trying to think of what his was, because Thomas S. Monson was never deny a prompting. He was very rooted in service.
Very big on service, reaching out to the poor and the needy. You know, one of the first things President Monson did was made that one of the stated missions of the church was to care for the poor and the needy, which was just a hallmark of his ministry as a disciple of Christ, you know.
Yeah. And so assuming that they select Russell M. Nelson, based on his past talks, addresses, and style of leadership, what kind of prophet or president can we expect him to be and put out in front of the world as, you know, the global leader of the church?
That's a really good question. And to be totally honest with you, I don't know. Sometimes when any of us step into any sort of a position of leadership, you know, we bring our own background and our own expertise to bear on it. And Russell M. Nelson has a background. He was a world-renowned heart surgeon before he was called into the apostleship full-time for the church. His messages have been they've touched a number of subjects. You know, he has spoken directly to the women of the church just recently, of the LDS Church. He has spoken pretty clearly on the need to honor the Sabbath day, for example. He touched on that in a number of his messages. So I don't know. I think we'll just kind of have to see if he is, if history holds with the precedent, and he becomes the president. I'm not sure I can say what his touchstone or hallmark of his ministry and focal point might be. I think it's open-ended right now, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's kind of an adventure for him, an adventure for the church, and, you know, for those of us who live here in Utah and are around the church a lot, it's you know, exciting to kind of see, like, okay, what's the next guy going to do? Where is he going to take the church, and how's he going to lead? It's exciting.
Yeah.
It is exciting. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I really appreciate it. You have brought a lot of clarity to something that can seem a little bit shrouded in, you know, mystery and just kind of some confusion. So this is really illuminating. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nish.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Anthony.
Yeah, take care.
You too.
Well, it sounds like there's, as you say, it's a well-oiled machine, not a lot of room for or precedent for kind of shaking things up, making a, say, Pope Francis selection, you know, to draw a parallel with another faith tradition that depends on a bunch of old men selecting the next leader.
Yep, that's kind of how it rolls. Oh, well, I will say there is the question of who could be called into the quorum, right? So it will almost assuredly be Russell M. Nelson, right? He's going to be the prophet. And he will select his two counselors from the quorum, which will be another two white dudes. So the first presidency will assuredly be three old white men. But there leaves a vacancy in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. And the last time there was a vacancy, there were actually two, or three. There were three vacancies, I think, that were filled. And a lot of people voiced disappointment that it wasn't a person of color. And so, because it has always been white men, always. And so that's the big question, looking at, you know, who's going to step into the open seat in the quorum, is could it potentially be a person of color? That is a big question.
Especially as the church has been growing so much more outside of the U.S.
Yes.
Than it has inside.
Yeah, especially in South America. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. It's all kind of up in the air. But
and are they all Americans? Do you know?
Yes, they're all Americans. Currently serving are all Americans. The current presiding bishop of the church, I think, is his title. So he oversees the majority of the church's humanitarian efforts, is French. Bishop Cossé is his name. So there's a chance he could be called. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. But currently it is all American white men. But it is a very, you know, has historically been a very, you know, white American faith tradition. Yeah, so we'll see how it plays out. But like you said, there's a lot of growth happening in South America and different parts of the world within the Mormon church. And so we will see. It's all very interesting. And obviously there's a lot of implications there with, you know, Utah politics, because, you know, the church and Utah politics is very intertwined here. And so it'll play out in some pretty interesting ways, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
All right. Well, thank you. I feel like we should give you a Daily Show type title, like official Salt Lake City LDS senior correspondent.
Official Mormon expert who's not Mormon correspondent or something. As all of my Mormon friends say, they're like, are you sure you're not Mormon? I'm like, I'm pretty sure I'm not Mormon. But yeah, it's kind of the benefit of living in Salt Lake City. You kind of can't get around knowing how the church operates, because it's just so much a part of everyday life of living here. So you just kind of learn it. But there you have it. That's the
story.
All
right. Well, that brings us to our main story this week, which is a tough one. And it's sadly way too familiar. So last week, a Texas woman went public with an allegation about Andy Savage. He is the founder and lead pastor of High Point Church in Memphis, which has three locations in the Memphis area. This woman, and I'm not going to name her here. You can find her name easily enough online, but I prefer not to. She says that in 1998, when she was a teenager and Savage was her youth pastor, he was driving her home from church and drove her into the woods one day and forced her to engage in sexual activity with him. When she finally mustered the nerve to tell others in the church about it, she was predictably lectured about her culpability. and is perhaps one small positive note that the church did eventually ask Savage to leave. It's unclear what the timeline was there, but they did cover up the reason why they didn't report the assault to outside authorities, as so often happens with institutions. And they later even considered bringing him back on staff, so they are not all in the clear here. An important detail in this story that feels almost inevitable whenever we hear about instances of sexual abuse in conservative evangelical settings is that Savage is and was a proponent of purity culture. In fact, the woman says that the assault took place just days before Savage led a True Love Waits workshop. Now, it's important for our listeners who aren't familiar with that to note that True Love Waits is not just a pro-abstinence movement. It advocates, actually, zero contact courtship. So there's no hugging, there's no kissing, there's no hand-holding, and even no dating without chaperones. One of the things we're going to talk about is the impact of that culture, because we are not really responsibly positioned to be able to judge how churches should police these incidents internally. But we can say that this past Sunday, Savage addressed the scandal at High Point Sunday services. And after he talked about it, and one of the fellow pastors at the church reminded the congregation that none of them were in a position to throw stones, the congregation gave him a standing ovation.
I think it's helpful for us to couch this and remember that this is not just a scandal, this was a crime. The young girl was underage. She was 17. I also saw something, it was a report maybe in the Fort Worth News, I can't remember, where he said he handled it biblically. I'm curious what that means. How does one handle something biblically? And also, because it was a crime, right? This was a man who was an adult assaulting, period, a woman, let alone a woman who was underage. Why the church didn't report it to the police? You and I talked a little bit earlier about how churches now and pastors, a lot of them are, I think, mandatory reporters in issues of abuse, especially with children. But that probably was not the case. If it is now, it probably wasn't the case in whenever this happened, 1998. And so that standard has changed. However, it doesn't make it any less enraging to me. I don't know about you, but it's, it makes me angry.
I mean, it fits in with what we've seen over the past so many years in terms of institutions being more concerned about protecting themselves than about protecting the most vulnerable. And not just the most vulnerable, but people who have already been victimized. So whether it's Penn State not reporting abuses of young boys to authorities, or military branches preferring to keep rapes between troops as internal matters, or the Catholic Church, we've just seen time after time, and I know it shouldn't be more upsetting for it to happen in a religious setting, but it is. And I think for me, it is because of the justifications that are made that, yes, this was the biblical way of dealing with it. And so often we hear that when what it means is a lot of pressure on the victim to forgive the abuser. That's what's biblical.
Which is its own kind of abuse.
Exactly. That's spiritual abuse.
Yeah.
One of the High Point pastors on Sunday actually picked up a stone, an actual stone, in the service and said,
no.
Do you want me to throw this stone at Andy?
No.
Do you want me to throw this stone at me? We're going to see what Jesus had to say about this, because none of us wants anyone to throw a stone. You never heal by hurting others. Making it zero sum, really. You're either you know, choosing to hurt everybody, or you don't do anything, which is not very different from, in secular circles, people using language like, is it really fair that, you know, Mark Halperin should be killed over accusations that he was incredibly sexually inappropriate and an abuser with people under his power? You know, nobody is killing these guys.
That's not what anyone is suggesting.
Nobody is stoning them to death.
That's not a thing.
They like accept responsibility and not put themselves in positions of power again.
Right. There are consequences to your actions. Like, a person can forgive you all the livelong day, but that doesn't excuse you or get you out of the consequence of your action. And I want to make it really, really crystal clear here with us and with our listeners. If you are in a position where you hear about an instance of sexual assault, especially of a minor, you must report it to the authorities. You have to. Like, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. You report it to the authorities. That's what you do, because it's a crime. It's a crime. It's not a scandal. It's not like an oopsie. It's a crime. It's a crime, and it's evil. It's horrible. It's all those things that we need to reckon with in every sense of, you know, spirituality and emotional abuse and all of those different ways, for sure. I'm not saying that there isn't a spiritual element to this. I'm a Christian. Of course, I believe there is. However, this is a legal issue. This is a matter of criminality. And if a person assaults someone else, period, but especially if they are underage, if they are a child, you have to report it to the authorities. Like, I cannot stress that enough. And I don't want to get bogged down into the details of, like, you know, what churches can and should do about, you know, their policies and everything else. I am not an expert, so I should not comment on that. However, I do know that if you know of a crime that happens, I do know that you report it. That's just what you do. And the fact that this church and this pastor got up with a stone and said, do you want to stone it? Like, what? That's not even a thing. That's not a thing that anyone is suggesting. Holy crap. How is that? That is so, like, not even inappropriate. It's just crazy. It's crazy, Amy. It's crazy. And it lets this guy off the hook, number one, and it shames the victim. It shames the victim. This woman who came out so bravely and told her story about being assaulted, and it was true. He admitted to it. And then this pastor gets up and says, oh, you want to throw a stone? Like, no. She wants him to, like, live up to the responsibilities of his actions and the consequences of his actions. That's not the same thing as stoning a person to death. Like, I cannot even believe that we are having this conversation about equating those two things. It makes me so angry. Ugh. Churches are the worst sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, it's, first of all, for that pastor this Sunday, that's spiritual malpractice, because instead
yes,
of
thank you
approaching this as a moment to teach the congregation and to help them work through difficult feelings and, you know, what we've seen in secular settings all fall of people, you know, like Savannah Guthrie talking on national TV about, what do you do when somebody you care about is also somebody who has done terrible things? You know, that is something that would be useful for a religious leader to help congregants work through. But this just closes down that discussion and implies that any criticism is
stoning.
Throwing a stone. Yeah, stoning.
Which is, oh, it's so hurtful. It's so manipulative. It's so abusive, not only to this woman who suffered the attack, but also to the congregants. I can't, like, the thing that keeps running in my mind is, I wonder, and I hate to think of it because you know that there's more than one. than just this woman. I can't help but wonder how many people that were sitting in that congregation that Sunday who also suffered at the hands of abuse, who suffered abuse, who suffered assault, either as a child or as an adult. And they had to sit there and listen to that, whether it was by this person who was accused or not, just in general, as a victim of sexual assault, as an adult or a child, to have to sit there in the congregation and listen to that. I can't imagine how hurtful that must have been and how painful that must have been for that person. It is an egregious offense to anyone who has suffered assault to say that from the stage and to victim shame in that way. It is absolutely abhorrent. And it truly makes me want to cry. It makes me want to cry thinking about those people who could have heard that and who were probably so hurt and felt so unsafe, who felt so unsafe in a place that they should feel safe. Church should be a safe haven for victims. It should be a safe haven for the abused and for children and for the vulnerable. And this pastor and his actions, the one who is accused and the one who stood by and essentially like made sure that he didn't have to live up to the consequences of his actions and who enabled him, made that church less safe for victims of assault. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking because this isn't, you know, this isn't the only church where this has happened. It's happened in the Catholic Church. It's happened across, I mean, in so many denominations and so many different faith traditions. Abusers are continually enabled and given power, and it has to stop. And this is why that like hashtag church too, that like, yes, it happens in Hollywood. Yes, it happens in boardrooms and it happens in business, but it happens in church too. And if we truly are living out the ethic of Jesus, who was safety for the vulnerable and stood for the marginalized, church has to be a place for those people first. And the minute that it's not is the minute that we have betrayed the love that Jesus has shown those people. And it's heartbreaking. And it should make us all super angry, super, super angry. So there's my sermon for today.
Amen.
Oh, it makes me so mad, so mad. It makes me mad when the church does this. And I'm tired of it.
Well, and I just want to bring it back to our earlier topic. Well, one of our earlier topics on women in ministry, because imagine being a woman sitting in that church. And I can't say 100% with certainty that High Point does not ordain women, but I'm looking at the staff website right now, and the pastoral team is a whole bunch of white dude bros, and the staff team is all women. So I'm gonna draw some conclusions here. What you were being told is that it would never be acceptable for a woman to have this position of being a religious teacher that is so exalted and so important. We could never let a woman hold it. But it's all right to let somebody who has admitted to sexually abusing a minor who was one of his students when he was a youth pastor. It's all right to let him be a pastor, and shame on us if we have a problem with that.
It's just the continual perpetuation of like the consolidation of power among men and keeping things the way they were. And gosh, it's just super hurtful. It's super hurtful.
Well, and I want to note before we wrap up here that this woman, who is very brave and who didn't have to make this public, I mean, it was 19 years ago, almost 20 years ago now. But she says she was moved to go public after seeing Andy Savage speak out on social media about some of the high-profile men who have been forced out of their jobs in the past few months, like Matt Lauer. So she saw a post that he had written where this is Andy Savage writing. He said, so saddened to hear of another high-profile person in the midst of sexual misconduct allegations. It's beginning to seem that sex on our own terms isn't working. Go figure.
Hmm. Rich.
To which we say, oh, church, you need to clean house and cleanse yourselves. You do not have all the answers. And in fact, your answers are causing problems. You know, Nish, you and I talked about this earlier, and I really don't want to go down this road today. But when I think about the damage that has been done in churches and other evangelical communities by the purity culture that really kind of hit its peak after my adolescence. So I was kind of lucky to miss a lot of that. The Josh Harris, I Kiss Dating Goodbye, and True Love Waits seminars. It has hurt women, but it has hurt men too. You know, 80% of my heart feels for that woman, but 20% of my heart also has to feel for Andy Savage. And not in a don't throw stones way, but in a, man, what we do to our boys when we tell them that this is the appropriate outlet for their feelings and for their hormones. We should not be surprised. We should still hold them to the standard that particularly when you are in a position of authority, you don't abuse somebody. You certainly never abuse a minor, and you nope. certainly don't do anything that's non-consensual.
Ever.
But is it surprising that things like this come out of that culture?
Right.
No, it is not.
Right. Yeah. Especially, I mean, this, the pastor getting up with the stone and saying, like, does anyone want to throw this stone at him? You know, it is a byproduct of, you know, making women feel like they and their bodies are the cause for men being unable to control themselves. And that by like dressing promiscuously or, you know, whatever, that like somehow like it's my responsibility as the woman to control the man's actions. Like it's all of this stuff like plays out ultimately in really destructive behavior. I'm thankful. I do want to end on at least a little bit of a hopeful note that like, I am thankful that I think the church is slowly, not fast enough, obviously, moving a little bit on this stuff, that is moving out of kind of the purity culture era. It sucks that now we're seeing kind of the manifestations of this and some really unhealthy behaviors among men. And I am thankful that so many women, whether it's in Hollywood, like we saw last night at the Golden Globes, or whether it's in business, or whether you know, it's in church, we are seeing more and more women because of the movement of Me Too and The Time Is Up and Church Too, that like more women are feeling emboldened to come out and tell their stories, which means that the cycle hopefully will inevitably be broken. And that's something to be thankful for in the midst of something that's really, really dark and really horrible and really evil, that all of this stuff has happened and that there are so many victims across all these different spectrums. But that it's happening. The needle is finally moving. The cycle is finally breaking because women are stepping up and saying, no more. The time is up. We're done. Me too. Like, and so many women have come out and said, no, I am a victim of harassment or assault or abuse, which is a sign that the tide is turning. And so I think that we can be thankful that I think there is a brighter horizon in our future of, you know, less and less women and less girls and boys for that matter, being victims of assault and harassment and rape and, yeah, I think it's good that all of this is finally coming to light, because you can't address anything that's in the darkness, right? Like, it has to be brought to the light for us to finally change. And so for that, I think we can be grateful that the more stories that come out, the more things are likely to change. And so that's a good thing.
I certainly hope you're right.
me too.
You know, to just mar your bright spot for a second. I just want to remind people that this, again, is why the response from High Point is so not helpful. Is as long as we continue to see this as a matter of individual sin, oh man, we are going to miss how institutions enable it and embolden it and create the culture that makes it possible. So we got to cut that out. Cut that sin right out.
For real. Cut that shit out. That's what I have to say.
All right, Nish, let's lighten up.
Okay. To wrap up the show, every week we like to leave you with a recommendation or two, maybe a TV show, a movie, or a podcast. Amy, I know what you've been watching this week, but I don't know if it's what you want to talk about. Are you going to talk about The Crown?
Oh, Nish, you've given me so much TV to binge, and I've binged all of it.
I'm sorry.
All of it. I've now watched all of
Godless.
I'm sorry,
I'm the worst influence.
I watched Nice Lady, the HBO comedy special. Loved it. Oh, my goodness. It was just, it was so refreshing to hear a woman doing comedy for women as a woman, not trying to be like a cool girl so the guys will like her. I loved it so much.
And women's comedy is funny. My husband was crying while we were watching it. It's funny.
I would say Noam was more cringing, but yes, it was. Yeah.
Oh, we were laughing. And shows our like moral standards.
I'm also now about 16 episodes into The Crown, so gone down that
You're
rabbit
welcome.
Hole. Thank you so much. But the one I'm going to highlight is a show that Noam and I have started watching together. We try to have one show we're watching because I'm always watching like 13 things at a time. And he has time for one. So we started on New Year's what is apparently just one of the most popular shows in Israel right now. And I'm going to, I don't even know how to pronounce it correctly, Fauda, F-A-U-D-A. It's a thriller about an Israeli counterintelligence unit that basically embeds or infiltrates Palestinian terrorist groups in the West Bank. And so the whole first season is about them trying to get to a guy who's been responsible for dozens of suicide bombings. And I never know with shows from abroad whether if it was like translated into American TV, I would find the plot just ho-hum, but because it's like based somewhere else and has accents, I'm riveted. But finding it really interesting. And the thing we keep debating is I came away from the first few episodes where they're just like, they just keep dropping into these Palestinian environments and like just walking around speaking flawless Arabic and being taken at, you know, sight as Palestinian Arabs. I wanted to know whether that would actually happen. Like, is it that hard for people in Israel and in the West Bank to tell the difference between Israeli Jews and Palestinians? Maybe it is. And if so, I find that completely fascinating. Because in an already like incredibly difficult and high tension area, you can understand that that would make people incredibly paranoid to think that somebody could just be in there as a mole and you wouldn't even know. But it's just one of the many really interesting parts of that series. So I will keep you updated because we are only a few episodes in and it is taking all of my self-control not to just binge the rest of them instead of waiting for Noam. But I know he's listening, so I am waiting.
Okay, so where is it? Is it on Netflix?
Oh, that is an excellent question. I believe it is on Netflix, yes.
Okay, Netflix. Good to know. Also, do we want to gush about the potential casting for season 3 of The Crown?
Yeah, we could do a whole episode about that.
Because the news that Helena Bonham Carter is going to play Princess Margaret, about Put Me in an Early Grave, I needed to be resurrected. I was...
I think she was my favorite actress from the first two seasons. As wonderful as Claire
Foy is. Oh,
she
was amazing.
There's just...
Yes.
Vanessa Kirby is electric.
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. And Matthew Good and... Well, I mean... But Helena Bonham Carter, forget it. I am sold. I am all the way in. She's one of my favorite actresses of all time. She is so magnetic. Everything she does is just extraordinary. So I hope that the third season will prove to be just as good. I'm sure it will. It's just such a good series. But okay, Fauda.
That's mine.
On Netflix.
Nish, what do you have for us?
Okay, mine... Oh, gosh. I have two things. They're both, albums. So one of them is I'm just going to go ahead and say it out loud and admit to it. I'm a Justin Timberlake fan.
There's no judging going on
here. I have loved him
here.
Since NSYNC. I know. Hate me all you want. It's fine. I'm a sucker for a good pop song. What can I say? So anyway, his new single is out on iTunes, and I can't remember what it's called. Shows you how much it's like Filthy or something. I can't remember. Is it Filthy? Filthy. That's the name of it. Anyway, that is one thing that I'm listening to. The other album. So his whole album isn't out yet. It comes out in February. But the new song is really catchy. It's a banger. I love it. I've been rocking out to it in my car. But the album that I am super, super into right now is an album called American Wilderness by Matt Hyers. And shout out to one Eric Weiseth, my husband, for discovering it. I cannot claim it. I have to give him credit. It is an incredible album. I told Eric, I said, I do not use this word lightly, but the dude is a prophet. It is actually, and it's not a Christian album. It's not. Like, there's cursing in it. It's great and fantastic musically, all these things. It's not a traditional contemporary Christian album. But the themes throughout every single song on the album are very, very Christian. And there is one song called The Wilderness is the title of the song. And I listen to it. Musically, it is not my favorite musically on the album, but lyrically, I listened to the first time, and I just started bawling at my computer because it truly felt like almost like my faith story, like my faith journey was written out in this like song form, and it was this call to all of these people who have felt like disenfranchised and have felt disillusioned and who felt like there is no place for them and who feel like, you know, they just feel forgotten. And he speaks so clearly throughout the whole album to that like group of people and to that generation of people who feel disillusioned and feel forgotten by the church, or just, you know, their faith tradition. And it is so good, Amy. It's so good. Like start to finish, it's lyrically one of the best albums I've heard in a long time. And I just cannot stop listening to it. We cannot stop listening to it. It's been on repeat in our house for days. So
to save listeners some Googling, because I just tried several versions of what I thought the name was, it's Matt Hyers, H-I-R-E-S.
Hyers, yes. Matt Hyers, H-I-R-E-S. And American Wilderness is the album, and it looks like kind of a silhouette against a starry sky is the cover of the album. And it came out in 2017, so it's his newest record. But so good. Yeah, please go listen.
I will give it a try. Would you like to know what we're listening to in our house?
Is it like VeggieTales or something? What are you listening to?
No. So I am slowly weaning us off the Christmas playlist.
Slowly.
But our little 4-year-old is in love with the Amy Grant Christmas album from 1986.
Oh, you are in heaven right now.
I can't tell you how happy this makes me.
You are beside yourself.
The song he wants to hear most often is Hark the Herald Angels Sing, and he will not be convinced that it is not Amy Grant's own personal composition. Like, he heard it sung in the Charlie Brown Christmas, and he wanted to know why they were singing Amy Grant's song.
Oh, as soon as you said Amy Grant, I knew. I was like, oh, Amy's about to spin into orbit with glee right now. Amy Sullivan is one of the biggest, like, 1980s Amy Grant fans that you will ever meet. Loves Amy Grant. So I love that little man loves Amy Grant Christmas. Oh my gosh, so cute.
You just have to understand two things. Like, when I watch the Christmas special, which was on CBS 1986, and I showed a little clip to Cormac, it comes just rushing back at me how much I wanted to be Amy Grant. Like, every piece of her wardrobe, I remember trying to, like, game out how I could get,
how can I replicate
to be like it. And it's so dated, but I wanted to be Amy Grant. But also, and this is in light of our last of 2017 episode about interfaith families, like, I never thought, once it was clear that Noam and I were going to get married, I never thought I was going to have kids who were going to church with me on a regular basis, much less loving the parts of Christian culture that I grew up loving. And so this is not going to last. But the fact that even for a short period of time, I have a little boy who loves Amy Grant just is bringing me so much joy.
And he's such a fan. He's such a hardcore fan that he thinks Hark the Herald Angels Sing is Amy Grant's song. I love it.
And he references her in other contexts. It just makes me so happy.
Oh, that is just the best. You are so happy. That makes me happy.
I'm tempted to, like, right away for a signed picture for him.
You probably should. You should plan on doing that next Christmas. See if you can snag one. That'd be amazing.
He'll be past it by then, but
well.
For now, I'm living in this moment.
I'm going to cross my fingers that it maintains for at least another year, just for your own emotional well-being. Okay, well, that is all for this week's episode. Thanks for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us and to expand these conversations as well. And as always, we will post the show notes on our Facebook page, Impolite Company, the podcast. And until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.